Today, the 18th of July in the glorious future year of 2026. Yes, friends, we are coming right up on the glorious 20th of July. All hail the glorious 20th of July. And this is my emergency backup show. If you are hearing this, it means I did not get to Hamburg and connected to the internet in time to do a live show from my hotel room in Hamburg. Which, of course, is entirely possible, as the other thing is, hotel Wi-Fi connections are not always stable enough to do a live show from. So, do I have anything to say that's useful? Well, of course, I have to pay some attention to the heat wave of June, which, according to the Robert Koch Institute, which is the German equivalent of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control or what have you, their big public health institute, resulted in well over 5,000 heat-related deaths across Germany, which is a colossal number. Heat-related deaths, of course, are very preventable, but that prevention is not necessarily something that most of Europe is prepared to do. As I have observed repeatedly, European construction techniques, certainly German construction techniques, are not amenable to forced air ventilation, and they haven't changed those techniques at all in any way. The thing is that they are built for heating in the winter, and they're built for heating in the winter with steam or hot water, with what you would call radiators, but are actually convectors, or with what are called convectors, and are a different kind of convectors, underneath the windows. Banks of pipe with fins, essentially. Unfortunately, this doesn't really work for cooling. Thermodynamically, it's okay, but in practice, what happens, of course, is that moisture out of the air condenses on the fins. You don't get cooling, you get a dehumidification effect, and then it drips off onto the floor. And then standing water builds up on the floor, which is just not a good scene. To do cooling, building cooling, space cooling effectively, you really need forced air ventilation. And from what I've seen of German construction techniques that are used for houses and small to medium-sized apartment blocks, and we're talking four floors, 20 or more flats, they simply are not oriented to forced air ventilation at all. You know, yes, you've got good insulation, and you've got these thick fired clay tile walls, and there's no room, really, for anything like ductwork. That's just not provided. So that becomes a problem. It also means, of course, that the interior of an apartment is not a space you can rearrange in any way, shape, or form. The rooms are fixed in place. There's no knocking out a wall, right? There's no changing the layout. You're out of luck. And if the plan and the actual space don't agree, well, guess what? They're not as-built plans. I mean, an engineer friend of mine says, never trust an as-built. But these are far from being as-built. Anyway, second thought, and this is just one of those cases where I'm like Big Bird with a switchblade, right? I'm a flightless bird, and you've activated my fight-or-flight response, and I'm a flightless bird. That's the joke. Sorry. Gave it to you punchline first, which doesn't work. Anyhow, point being, I went over to the pharmacy to buy some headache pills. And over by the subway station, the AFD, the Alternative für Deutschland, had their tent set up. Now, in my opinion, if they were really serious, they'd be the AFT. They'd spell it Deutschland with an initial T, which used to be the standard spelling, I think. Certainly it's the spelling that the King of Bavaria used, although I will admit he was addicted to non-standard spellings, such as when he replaced the I in Bayern with a Y because he liked the letter better. Ludwig I, it has to be explained, was a great classicist. And the Y in German is derived from the Greek upsilon. And he thought that made the word Bayern much classier. So he just changed the spelling, and because he was the king, everybody agreed with him. But yeah, he used Deutschland with a initial T, not a D. That's tango, not delta. Anyway, getting off of that particular derailment for a moment, the alternative for Deutschland, I mean, I walked by their stand and I told them two things very angrily, which are A, that in my considered opinion, the only realistic alternative, the only acceptable alternative to a Germany which is fully integrated with other European nations is no Germany whatsoever. And I would vote for that before I voted for them, if I voted in German elections. Dissolve Germany entirely, annex the left bank of the Rhine to France up to its confluence of the Meuse, and then beyond that to Luxembourg and Belgium. Dismember the rest into, you know, maybe annex Schleswig-Holstein to Denmark again. Give the whole of Brandenburg over to Poland, whatever, and let the rest be states, but not, you know, let Bavaria be an independent state and so on, but no Germany. The other thing, you know, not going to the full extent of the Morgenthau Plan, which said, you know, just, we can't have this anymore, we just need to demolish all the German cities and forbid Germany from ever having any industry again. The Morgenthau Plan was terrifying. We did the Marshall Plan instead. Whether or not that was a good idea is still kind of up in the air, I guess. Anyhow, but the thing about it is, the other thing I said to them, again, very angrily, was that German nationalism is idiocy, and the idiocy of German nationalism has never been better proved than by the Revolution of 1848. I think I've talked about the Revolution of 1848 before, but it bears saying again. So, in the fall and winter of 1847, spring of 1848, the German people rose up on their hind legs. They said, we want to determine our fates, not these idiot princelings and so on. We want to act as a nation, not as a bunch of scattered principalities that all speak roughly the same language. And they terrified the German princes. They put the fear of God, or at least the fear of the masses, into them. And the German princes, very much terrified, right, cowed, granted them a diet. And so the representatives of the German people, the German nation, assembled in Frankfurt on the Main, which is the historical, traditional place for this. And they convened. And all they bloody did was convene. They convened and convened and convened for 9 months and accomplished nothing. At the end of the year, when most of the representatives had gone home in disgust, realizing they weren't going to accomplish anything, the rump of the Frankfurt Diet offered the imperial crown to the King of Prussia, who refused it with a historically unique reason. I have never heard of anyone else who said anything like this. The historically unique reason that he was a king by divine right, and he refused to accept any dignity that was elective. Right? He refused to accept election to any dignity. Bloody insane thing to say. But he said it. Anyhow, and that's my opinion of the alternative for Deutschland. They're a bunch of yammerheads. I mean, I completely agree that the parties in power in Germany have essentially discredited themselves, that they have no real mandate. But idiocy and nonsense is not a replacement. Sorry, guys. Anyway, my next show like this may come to you from aboard the Queen Mary, because the reason I'm going to Hamburg, in case you hadn't heard, is to board the Queen Mary. And Tuesday the 28th, I'll be in New York City, and then I'll go to Chicago spend the weekend in Chicago visiting my sibling, and then head home to Fort Worth, where I will spend most of August. I may or may not attend the World Science Fiction Convention at the end of August. I'm not 100% certain yet. And then it's probably back to Europe in September, but when and as I get back to Germany, I am not going to be coming to you from Munich. I'll be coming to you from Eching, which is a sort of suburb of Munich. It's really a little town halfway between Munich and Freising. Freising is where the Munich airport is. So it's in Landkreis Freising, not Landkreis München, where Landkreis is an administrative district. And that will be my home base in Germany for the foreseeable future. So I may be in Europe September, October, November, return to the States in December. That's not settled yet at all. Very uncertain. A lot of it will depend also on the progress of my minting projects and what weird things I have to do to get them done. I may end up taking the money which I was going to spend on coinage projects and actually using it to build a mint, which has been an ambition of mine for a long time. I've got to figure out how much it's going to cost and how long it's going to take. I don't know either of those things yet. Anyway, thanks for listening. Send those cards and letters to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll read them when I get back to the States, and I'll probably read them on the air. I'll probably send you something in return. If you like these broadcasts, of course, always feel free to support me. Send me some money at paypal.me/prometheuslives, or for a continuing contribution, patreon.com/publius_reads. Checks and money orders to the above address are, of course, always acceptable, but you might not want to mail wads of cash. And as a quick note, I did just send out 3 parcels to European Patreon subscribers. One of them is actually in Britain. I'm going to be in Britain on Tuesday, but the postal rates in Britain are so bad that it's not necessarily any more expensive to send it international mail from Germany than it is to send it by domestic mail from Britain. That's pretty bad, isn't it? Anyway, talk to you later. Be safe out there. ...is to place things into a context. And what is the context that I want you to place yourself in, that I want you to place these facts in? Well, the context is actually quite simple. It's provided, I think, by Carl Sagan very eloquently when he says, you know, that the surface of the Earth is like the shore of a cosmic ocean, and we have waded out a little ways, and that's all. This is important. Right. I've been known to say, again, that there's no use fighting over territory on Earth when there's such a vast cosmos out there in all its immensity, in all its majesty. Right. There's no sense in arguing about oil reserves on Earth when the sun produces enough energy every 24 hours to take a mass of ice, the mass of the Earth, melt it, raise it to the boiling point, and boil it. Right. That's a lot of energy. But this is the point, right? The idea that we are in a time of transition, and people are looking at this transition as leading us towards end points, whereas it is far, far more valuable to look at this transition, this period of change, to look at these changes as they occur, as leading us towards beginning points. That's the key. That's the key, if you're listening still, despite my diatribe and all that. It's not merely the idea that, as one of my friends likes to express it, a lunar colony, for example, a lunar settlement, would be hope for the future in the same way that a newborn child is. That, of course, is Benjamin Franklin's famous line. Upon seeing a balloon ascension, someone said, "What use is this?" And his response is, "What use is a newborn baby?" Not to be confused, although it frequently is confused, with Michael Faraday's response after he demonstrated electricity and electromagnetism to the British Parliament. When someone asked, "Well, what's the use of all this?" And he said, "Someday, sir, you will tax it." So, this is the key to understand. We are in a time of transition. There are many people who are trying with might and main to hold back that transition because they cannot believe that any change is a change for the better. It's in their way of thinking, in their minds, change, because it leads to what is not familiar to them, because it leads to what is not comfortable for them, because it leads to something they're not already in control of, change is necessarily bad and to be resisted. My friends, no! Change is inevitable. You cannot escape from change. The key, then, is to shape change. Accept that changes will occur, accept that changes must occur, accept that changes are occurring no matter whether you like them or not. Look for the changes that you feel make the world as it is more like a world that you think is worth living in, more like a world that has a future that you would think of as worth living in. Right? This is the key. Treating the world as static is always going to fail. It's always going to be a losing proposition because the world is not static and the world does not move between static states. Lyell's geology, Lyell's gradualism should have exploded that notion once and for all. What we are now beginning to understand, sometimes described as punctuated equilibrium, but that's a fairly poor way of putting it because it implies that there are sudden transitions between static states. No. The equilibrium states are themselves conditions of change. Punctuated equilibrium doesn't mean static conditions interspersed with sudden changes from one set of condition to another. Rather, it means condition of change succeeded by another condition of change, different changes. We are in one of these punctuation points, and the trouble is people keep treating it as though it were a full stop. Half the effect of that peroration, I admit, is completely ruined by the fact that you cannot see me glaring into the microphone with my, you know, very purposeful and determined expression. But, I'll leave you to think about that while I explain a little more about the gold standard, which I've been talking about for the past 2 weeks. So, as I sort of told you, in the 18th century, Britain was de facto on the gold standard, in the sense that gold was undervalued in terms of silver, gold was overvalued in terms of silver, or silver was undervalued in terms of gold, so that people who had large payments to make would make them in gold. The unintended and highly undesirable consequence of this is that there was a serious shortage of the smaller forms of money that people use in day-to-day transactions. The crown and the half crown and the shilling and the sixpence and the threepenny bit, and so on. Or the groat or fourpence. These were largely not in evidence because they were worth more melted down than they were in coin. Well, that was clearly an undesirable situation. But nobody could seem to know how to solve it. There were solutions that would have worked. One being a seigniorage tax, whereby if you brought silver shillings to the mint, silver to the mint to be coined, you would get shillings that weighed 62 to the pound, but for each pound of silver you brought in, you would only get 60 of them back, and the mint would retain 2 as a form of tax. This would have worked, but it was ruled out by a settlement from the period of the Restoration, where the king gave up the right to charge seigniorage. It would actually have helped, because it would have given the silver coin an artificial value above its value as bullion. Of course, giving the coin an artificial value above its value of as bullion then completely invalidates the underlying theory of metal money, that you are exchanging something which has a certain commercial value for something else which has a certain commercial value. Whether or not that underlying theory has ever been strictly true is another interesting question. There is good evidence to suggest that gold and silver acquired their commercial value primarily from a psychological value, and particularly from religious or numinous associations, so that we do not know whether the first coined money as we know it, the Electrum One-Third Staters of Lydia, we do not know whether these served a function as a medium of exchange or not. We know they were used in payments, but whether they were used in exchange is another question. I know that sounds like a strange distinction, but what you have to understand is the finds of these coins in situ in archaeological excavations in the old cities of Lydia, they tend to turn up more in the temples than they do in the marketplaces. Suggesting that the coins had a ritual value above and beyond the value of the metal that was in them for other purposes, if it had any other purpose. Now, the really interesting part of all this, of course, people refer to the Electrum One-Third Staters of Lydia. Everyone knows that electrum is a naturally occurring alloy of gold and silver found in the sands of the river Pactolus. And people just assume that these Electrum One-Third Staters are made from naturally occurring electrum, and they're not. The composition of the alloy of the Electrum One-Third Staters of Lydia is different from that of the natural electrum washed from the sands of the Pactolus, which tells us that there was deliberate alloying and refining going on. That's subsidiary to my main point, of course, but I thought it was important to bring up because I think things like that. So yes, through most of the 18th century, the business of Britain was carried on in a very unsatisfactory way, with tradesmen's tokens for small quantities, such as a penny, very little good coin in circulation for payments below 7 shillings or 10 shillings, and then 1/3, 1/2, and 1 guinea pieces for 7, 10.5, and 21 shillings correspondingly. And then for large sums, some people would bring in gold and some people would deal in banknotes. Then, of course, you have the French Revolution, you have the outbreak of wars. And what happens in the case of wars? Well, people lose confidence, they go to the banks and draw their money out, and suddenly the Bank of England doesn't have the gold to pay with, because the thing that fractional reserve banking assumes never happens happened, everybody coming to the bank all at once to get their money out. Parliament and the Crown produce orders saying that the bank doesn't have to pay its notes in gold for the present emergency, and that continues until from about 1798 to 1818. And so all large transactions during that period are done in paper. Small transactions, it's very interesting. There's now a good regal copper coinage, so the small denomination tradesman's tokens, the pennies and halfpennies made in the Isle of Anglesey from Welsh copper, that kind of thing, the druid head pennies, those disappear. The Condor tokens, as they're known, those disappear. But what appears are larger denomination tokens. 3, 4, 6, 10 penny tokens, half crowns, crowns, Spanish dollars countermarked. All of them, at least in theory, you could bring back to the people who issued them, and in sums of around £5, you would get banknotes for them. This is all, you know, very interesting. But what it means is that by the period 1818, when gold begins to enter freely into circulation again, people in Britain are very accustomed to using banknotes. But yeah, they bring in a new silver currency, which is now lighter, 66 shillings to the pound, and that currency remains in circulation until 1918. Just at the end of the First World War, the global price of silver spiked briefly as a result of the various twos and fros that were going on at that time, after being severely depressed for 50 years previous, almost, 40 years previous, the global price of silver spiked suddenly. Britain reduced the content of silver in its coinage from 925,000ths all the way down to 500,000ths. It remained at that level until 1946, when the silver coinage was replaced by copper-nickel coinage. And that copper-nickel coinage remained in circulation until the 1990s, when it was replaced by a smaller copper-nickel coinage. This is, again, somewhat to the side of the whole concept of the gold standard, but it reminds you that in a modern world, coins are not circulated and they're intrinsic so-called value. You don't take the 5-cent nickel in the United States and think of it as 5 cents of copper nickel alloy and swap it for a small portion of something that in the great commodity markets of Chicago would fetch, you know, copper fetches such and such per ton, nickel fetches such and such per ton, this other thing you're buying fetches such and such per ton. Because the prices of copper and nickel in the market fluctuate daily. Prices of other things in the market fluctuate daily. It doesn't make sense. Rather, you are swapping something that alludes to an exchange value. Because fundamentally, the whole concept of money is in the mind, not in the physical world. That the notion of intrinsic value itself is misleading because, of course, even a gold coin only has the value you give to it. The industrial uses of gold and silver are certainly real, and they compete with monetary uses. But it's not as simple as that. And I realize that saying it's not as simple as that is a cop-out, and yet I'm going to say it anyway, because I'm afraid that I can't tell you what to think or believe. I can give you hints as to what I think is worthwhile to think or believe. You can give me feedback. Tell me why you think I'm full of nonsense. What's the best way of doing that? Probably it's to send me a card or a letter. Send those to Man and Adam, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll be happy to read them out on the show, probably. I'll probably be happy to send you something in return. Now, if you just appreciate these broadcasts and would like to support them, you...
This might be a terrible idea. Oh, boy. Okay. Here we go. The current time is 1930 UTC, and that means it's time to begin another thrilling episode of The Dubious Gold's Committee, also known as the Sinus Committee. Okay, hello. Welcome to the Dubious Gold's Committee. My name is Tobe. I'm your local chairman and host. And I am outside today, again, but we've got to be careful. We've got to be